Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
I wonder how we're going to reflect on 2014 in years to come, perhaps even while you're listening to this now. The spectacle of the Sochi Winter Olympics, the Soccer World Cup in Brazil, the loss of loved ones in two separate Malaysian Airlines disasters, Ebola, the emergence of ISIS. Eagle Psychology's Lisa Aitken is here to encourage us to look positively at our world, for both our own well-being and for those around us. In our Omnibus edition, Lisa highlights the gifts of gratitude and hope in our lives. And we start with gratitude, feeling or action.
Yeah, well, it certainly is a feeling of thankfulness. You're right in that. But we take it a little step further and we argue that it's an attitude and it's a stance towards life that you can intentionally develop, which isn't probably something that most of us do. Most of us, it just emerges out of, you know, the happenstance of life, whereas we argue that it's a really good thing to actually develop. So there's a psychologist by the name of Robert Emmons who's done a lot of work on gratitude, and he argues it has two stages. So the first is you see something good in life. You see what you're thankful for and you acknowledge it. So the actual putting it into words is a really important part of gratitude. Mm-hmm. And then the second step is you recognise the source of the goodness. So you express that thankfulness to the person or to God or, you know, wherever you see the source.
Lisa, what are some of the benefits of living a life grounded in gratefulness?
So the research has tended to be, what they do is they'll get two groups of people and they'll ask one group to keep a gratitude journal. So to each day write down some really quite specific things that they're thankful for, and maybe even share that with the people to whom they're thankful. But those who keep a gratitude journal regularly, it actually impacts their health. They have fewer illness symptoms, their immune systems work better, they have lower blood pressure. And in the world of psychology, we often use health measures because they're nice and concrete to look at what is psychologically healthy. That it's, you know, obviously a good sign if it correlates with health measures. But equally, they also felt happier. People who kept this gratitude journal, they were more optimistic about the future. They had less depression. They had higher coping capacity with everyday stress. They even slept more hours. They noticed that if people kept a gratitude journal before they went to bed, they actually got literally, you know, more time asleep. Wow. And more refreshing sleep. And one that they weren't expecting, which in hindsight they were saying it makes sense, but they hadn't predicted, was that it made people feel closer and more connected to other people in their lives, and they were more likely to act with compassion and generosity if they'd been noticing the good everywhere. It had this general positive impact on them.
Lisa, in living a life of intentional gratitude, sometimes the walls of our life close in around us. How do we push them back? What steps can we take in those early stages of looking for opportunities to be grateful?
I think the idea of keeping the journal is a really good one.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's human nature that we take things for granted, isn't it? Or we have high expectations of life, and so anything less than perfection we don't appreciate. So often people start doing it every day, but it really doesn't need to be every day. But writing down maybe three things, but keeping them pretty specific, three things you're grateful for and to whom you're grateful. So it can't be, you know, every day I'm grateful for the weather and I have food and I have, I don't know, a family. You know, it needs to be quite specific to that day. Mm. Martin Seligman, another positive psychologist, has what he calls it, the what went well exercise. Yeah. Or the count your blessings exercise. So just for 10 minutes before you go to sleep, you write down three things that have gone well. If every day you're writing those things down and then meditating on them and how thankful you are for them, then you know that the next day you're going to have to do that again. And so you start to have eyes to see and you think, oh yes, I'm going to write that in my gratitude journal tonight. There's a good one for it.
Yeah.
Another idea that Martin Seligman has is a gratitude letter. So he actually asks people to think of someone in your life that you're really grateful for and they've done something great for you, but you've never really thanked them or explained, you know, how they've helped you or benefited you. And he says, write down just about, say, 300 words, really specifically, of what they did and how it's helped, and post it or drop in on a surprise visit. And what he found was that, I mean, of course, the person receiving the letter felt great, but the person who gave the letter, that the happiness benefits of that endured for a long time. You know, it feels really good to offer thanks to other people when they've helped us. Another aspect which I've spoken of before is this idea of slowing down and being mindful of the small things. So, you know, let's say you're going on your daily walk for some exercise and you happen to look up and you're slowing down and you're trying to just notice clouds or notice trees or just be in the present moment. And often, for me, that just swells up into gratitude to God for this amazing creation. But the slowing down process and choosing to be thankful for small things. Another is, there's a fantastic marriage researcher called John Gottman, and he has an exercise which he calls the Thanksgiving exercise. And I love this one. So what you do is, just for a week, as a little training exercise, every time in your head you've been judgmental or critical of your spouse, you jot it down, and then your task is to turn that into Thanksgiving. And then that day you have to go to your spouse and tell them something that you're thankful for.
Wow.
So I was in preparation for this, I'm practicing this. So yesterday the example was, my husband left the pile of clothes that I had lovingly washed and folded, and they were still sitting by his bed and he hadn't put them away. But I could hear the judgment in my head, the grumble, grumble.
Yes.
And then I thought, actually, the reason he didn't put them away yesterday was he was clearing out all his beekeeping stuff, and because he's wanting today to get alongside a young guy from church and encourage him and teach him beekeeping. And I thought, I'm going to say to my husband, you know, I think it's really fantastic that, you know, what you're doing in this, even though you didn't get to put the clothes away, and to thank him for that heart that he has. So it's nice to Gottman's idea is, we need to switch this around. You know, his research says we need to have 5 positive interactions for every 1 negative interaction to keep a relationship healthy. And he says, so it's a way of switching around a criticism into something that you're actually thankful for.
Lisa, life's not always easy though, is it? So how do we keep gratitude real when times are tough?
Of course, the psychological research has tried to address this, because when life is tough, it is really much harder to be grateful.
Yeah.
And so some of the researchers actually went to people who were really struggling with severe disabling illnesses, or people caring for those with disabilities or dementia, and were talking to them about, could they find things to be grateful for, and looking at those who chose to be grateful versus those who didn't. And the researchers were saying at first they felt really a bit nervous about even asking the question, but they were really quite surprised by the results, and which was that those who could see had eyes to see, even in the small things, aspects that they could be thankful for, coped much better. And almost everyone, even though they were going through really tough times, could find small mercies and beyond mercies things to actually be thankful for. And then they went the next step and they were looking at carers of those with Alzheimer's, so people actually living with those with quite advanced dementia. And they got half of them to keep these gratitude journals where they were listing what they could find to be grateful for, and the others had to just list life and what was going on and some of the hardships. And those, again, who kept the gratitude journals coped much better. They were less stressed. They had more optimism. And they noted how they then had eyes to see all the little victories and the little celebrations. So I guess cultivating, what they found in that research too was, people who cultivated gratitude in the easier times, when the hard times hit, they were more likely to, again, to be able to see what they could be thankful for. And that actually helped them cope much better in the hard times. And I think I recently had an example of this, where my husband had a bad bicycle accident a few months back, came off his push bike. And, you know, I got the call from the ambulance rocked up at the hospital. He's in a coma, and the neurosurgeon said he might have brain damage, you know, could be a lifelong brain injury. Of course, went home that night, didn't sleep at all, just pondering what this would mean. You know, my theology said I needed to thank God in the bad times as well as the good times. I was pleased that at the end of this long night of struggle and thinking, what could this mean, I could say, thank you, God, that I know you're going to turn this for good. Thank you, God, that what you will do with this is make me more like Jesus somehow. And that the process, I think, of being able to find something to be thankful for was a really helpful way to spend that night in a really awful circumstance. As it turned out, he didn't have a brain injury. He's had other injuries which have gone on. And I have contemplated that for those people who, you know, who are 10 years later still caring for someone with a brain injury, that's where the rubber hits the road, isn't it? But yeah. I think it is the same thing. When God calls us to be thankful in all circumstances, it's having the eyes to see that what he's doing in us, it's not about making life easy. He's not about just bringing us happiness. He's about molding us to speak the language of heaven and become more like Jesus. And I think I sit with clients who are struggling and suffering day in, day out, and we have these conversations all the time about, again, it's the eyes to see God at work, and it's choosing to see God at work in that way that leads to a sense of thankfulness.
I'm sure also there have been times in your clinic where your clients have come to you with a sense of hopelessness. So let's turn to hope. What is it, clinically speaking, psychologically speaking, and how do we measure it?
Well, I'm doing a thesis on this at the moment, so I'll try not to rant too much.
Perfect.
At the moment, hope is seen as having two aspects. So hope is seen as, if you are pretty confident that you are good at achieving your goals, so that's called agency. Mm-hmm. And then the second aspect is, if you're good at coming up with multiple pathways to solve problems, so we call that the sort of pathways component. So those two things, then you have hope. Now, I started reading a lot of the research on this, and it's true that those two things do correlate really highly with lots of well-being measures. People tend to be successful if they're, which sort of makes sense. If you're good at coming up with goals and thinking of solutions and pathways to goals, that, you know, you'd be successful in life.
Yeah.
But my argument is, and this is what my thesis is on, that hope is so much more than that. And I think that two things need to be added, and I'm certainly not the only person who's arguing this. One is relationships, that if you think about what the scriptures say, they call us to hope in God over and over. You hope in, whether it's God or in another person. If you're going in for surgery, you are hoping in your surgeon's capacity and skill. Your own success at goals or ability to come up with pathways is utterly irrelevant. And so being able to hope in another. And the other thing, you know, when I was lying there for that night contemplating what life was going to be like after my husband's accident, it was so much of my hope was also in the relationships that were around me. I knew I'd get through no matter what happened because I had friends and family who were around who'd be supportive. So I think you can't take away relationships from a sense of hope. And the other aspect that I think really needs to be there is your place in the bigger story of life. Now, I speak to people all the time in counselling sessions who may have had all sorts of goals for their life, but it hasn't quite worked out the way they thought. And yet they can see how it's all been part of a bigger story, how it's all been heading somewhere. And whether they're Christian or not Christian, but for the Christians who see that, there is this sense of they are part of a much bigger narrative. So the jargon we use is part of a meta-narrative, a much bigger story that their little life story fits into. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not surprising that psychology has shrunk hope down to just the self, which is really what it's done, because if you think about the times we're in and this idea that some people define postmodernism, that we've given up any sense that we're part of a bigger story, the death of the meta-narrative is how some people define it, that all of us, we all seem to, like, society has shrunk down to just us as little individuals living our little lives, whereas I think it's really time to pull back and see that hope is part of where we see ourselves in a much bigger story, whether it's the story of our family, the story of what brings meaning to our life, the story of what God's doing in our life, and that is done in the context of relationships. I can't give you hard data yet because I've only just started my thesis, so give me about 5 years.
Sure.
And I'll come back with some. But certainly done a lot of reading around the research and a lot of reading of the scriptures and this idea. I think they're both really there, that hoping in God, hoping in the context of relationships, and also that our hope is part of... You know, I've talked before about how when we're really stressed and anxious, our thinking narrows and we sort of just, life becomes just looking at our feet and, oh, how do I cope with the next step and the next step and the next step? Whereas hope means that we look out and we see the people who are journeying this with us, and we look up and we see a God who's there and we look ahead. I mean, hope is a really future-focused emotion, that when we look ahead, we see these relationships supporting us, and we see this God who is at work in front of us, and not just now or behind us. He's at work in front, and who knows what exciting possibilities there are there. And for us as Christians, our ultimate hope, of course, is that we have a sure destination, and we're walking a path with God leading, and it's always going to be up and down and sideways and in and out, because that's the nature of life. But I think if we see all those winding paths as part of a bigger story that's done alongside people, then that really is what hope is all about.
Lisa, we've come not only to the end of our conversation, but the end of our year together. Thank you so much for sharing it with us this year.
Oh, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you very much for having me, Dwayne.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.